This episode is sponsored by Smart Travel, a new podcast from NerdWallet. You know that one friend who always finds the best travel deals, picks the right cards, and somehow ends up in first class for the price of coach? Well, Smart Travel is like that friend, but in podcast form. They cover all things travel finance, like which airport lounges are worth it and which are basically free Wi-Fi and chairs, and how travel advisors can snag secret perks you didn't even know to ask for, or how to get real value from points, not just a tiny reward at checkout. Travel smarter and spend less with help from Nerd Wallet. Follow Smart Travel wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a Voyascape podcast. You can find all of our travel podcasts from around the world at voyascape.com.
And welcome to the Fromer Travel Show. I'm your host, Pauline Fromer. Our guest today is Andrew McCarthy. And that's a name you may recognize because Andrew has had a long and varied and very public career. He hit it big in the 1980s, starring in such iconic films as Pretty in Pink and Less Than Zero. He became a director. And the reason he's on this show is he also became a very accomplished travel writer. He was the editor-in-large for National Geographic Traveler. He's written four best-selling travel memoirs, and I think his fifth will also be a bestseller. It just came out. It is called Who Needs Friends? An Unscientific Examination of Male Friendship Across America. Hey, Andrew, welcome back to the Fromer Travel Show.
Hi, Pauline. Good to see you.
Well, good to see you, too. So tell our listeners, what was the impetus for the journey that led to this book?
Yeah, I was sitting at the kitchen table with my son. He was sitting on the floor messing around with his guitar, and he was telling me a funny story about one of his buddies. And he finished it. We laughed, and he looked up at me, and he said, "You don't really have any friends, do you, Dad?" And I looked at him and I thought, there's more to the story of my life than my children are aware. And I said, "Yeah, Sammy, I have friends. I just don't see them, but I know they're there, and that's enough." And he kind of went, "Okay, whatever that means." And the comment stayed with me, though, for a couple of days. And I realized, you know what? It's not enough. I need to go see my friends. And I, like many people, guys, I think particularly when I was young, I moved to New York when I was 17, and I got this core group of friends who were really instrumental in me becoming who I would become in life, you know, and they were my sort of chosen family, I guess we'd call them now. And we were really close. And over time and jobs and careers and families and all sorts of things, they scattered around the country the way we do. And I realized I hadn't seen any of them in years and some of them in decades. And I thought, I just need to go see my friends. And so I got in the car, and because I hate driving on interstates, I took back roads and drove 10,000 miles across America to reconnect with my friends.
Yeah, yeah. And you were very much on trend in figuring this out. You have a very interesting part in the book where you talk about all the studies that have been done on male friendship. And I'm going to read your book to you. You said, men, it turns out, have lost the knack for friendship. 15% of men confess to having no close friends at all, up from 3% in 1990, while less than half of men say they're satisfied with how many friends they have. Only 1 in 5 men report receiving any form of emotional support from a friend in the prior week. And among those with only a high school diploma, 24% of men admit to having no friends whatsoever. You also talk about how it can increase Alzheimer's. I mean, this is a national pandemic of a kind, international, probably.
It's a funny thing. Yeah, I mean, it's particularly the loneliness notion, you know. Why I always thought of loneliness as sort of like, oh, that's very sad. But as you started pointing out there at the end, it has all sorts of physical manifestations as well, loneliness and isolation. It has, yeah, 50% increase at risk of dementia, like a 38% increase of heart disease. It's equivalent to, I think, smoking 15 cigarettes and 6 alcoholic drinks a day.
Wow.
Physically, how it manifests. So I think loneliness is a real sort of, and I think there's a lot of shame in it. So people don't want to talk about it, particularly men, you know, because I went across the country. I began not just seeing my friends, but I began talking to men all over the country about their experiences with friendship. And that to me was the most fascinating part of
my
journey, was talking to these random men about their experiences with friendship.
And just before we get back to the journey itself, I thought it was very interesting. You looped in the fact that this crisis is a new one. Men used to have stronger friendships, used to make sure that those bonds endured. And where did you get the evidence for that?
Well, some of the statistics you were talking about mentioned, you know, in 1990, I think it was 3% of men said they had no close friends. Now it's whether 16% or something. And, you know, but if you look back even to go back to the 19th century, like Abraham Lincoln and Joshua Speed were an example of just men that had a deep, intimate, close friendship. You know, if we look at some of their letters and other men's letters from that time period in the 19th century, they read to us like love letters. I mean, we'd be embarrassed to read those letters now. And there was a great physical affection with men. And I think somewhere along the line, by the time World War II ended and John Wayne had told America how to be a man, that you become, you know, stoic, lone wolf, pull your hat down and get it done and don't complain and just be a silent type. You know, that became the ideal of American manhood, and I think to our detriment. I think we know better than that now, and yet I think it's still such a dominant factor in the idea of what it is to be a man in this country. Yeah. So it's, you know, we're not doing ourselves any favors, men, by isolating in that way, willfully isolating.
Yeah, and I would probably say that the internet makes it worse. So you went analog.
Yes and no, although I have to say, Pauline, because, you know, and then I'll jump out of this. I was on a book tour recently, and a woman was there at one of my events, and she said, you know, I was listening to the book in the car with my dad, and it got him, who was in his 90s, and it got him thinking about this friend he had, who was very close with in high school. And they looked him up and they found him on Facebook. And so they drove to see him, and they had this reunion after 60 years. And they, every day now, they're on Zoom calls together, talking to each other and everything, and they've reconnected. So, I mean, technology is absolutely a hindrance and an isolator, but it also still can be a wonderful connector.
Yeah, no, that's very true. I've reconnected with a lot of friends on Facebook who then I see when I'm traveling.
Yeah.
So it's
great you're traveling in that way, because it does connect you. Because when you're out there on the road, you're a little more adventurous. You do make that connection.
Yeah, absolutely. So you went around the country to see these specific friends. But having this goal in mind, it also emboldened you to talk to people, to just strike up conversations. And this brought me to, I always think if you're on a pilgrimage of any kind, it's usually a better trip. If you have a goal, especially one that will connect you with others, that's to me the best way to travel. Do you agree?
Absolutely. Even just the tiniest little kind of silly quest you're on can be give a trip a focus that it just gives it that focus, which makes it an active thing as opposed to just sort of an aimless wandering in a certain way. Absolutely. And in this, I had, hopefully it was a little more than just a minor thing. It was the main focus. I would just approach random men on the street and just say, hey, can I talk to you about your friends? You know, so I got some crazy looks, but no one said no to talking to me, you know, which was amazing. But I do think you're absolutely right. Giving any kind of little focus or a little quest you're after on a trip is a great way to give it an extra meaning.
Yeah, yeah. And because your friends were pretty widely spaced all around the country, you got to see a lot of the United States. So I want to talk about some of the places you went. And one of them I'd never heard of before, Point Pleasant in West Virginia. Why did Point Pleasant become famous? And is it worth visiting today?
Well, I stumbled upon it. Like everything on my trip, I stumbled upon it because I should back up how I wandered 10,000 miles. Was like I mentioned, I didn't want to be on interstates. And I also didn't want to be told, I hate being told what to do by anyone, particularly my phone. And so I got off the GPS and I got a big old Rand McNally Road Atlas, one of those big, huge books that have like, you know, a page for every state and more.
Love it.
I just got the map book and I just sort of would look at what seemed the least crowded and I would go, I'm going to go there. And I went to Point Pleasant in West Virginia, which is on the western edge of Western, between Ohio and West Virginia, because there was a bridge and I needed to get over to Ohio and down to Kentucky. And so I ended up, as the night was falling, and this is how I did my whole trip. It started to get dark and I go, oh, I guess I better stop. And I found this crazy hotel and this town seemed largely like a ghost town. You could tell it had had its glory days back in the past. And it had become famous apparently in the 60s because it's this thing called the Mothman, this creature that these kids had discovered with that looked like kind of some giant bug thing. But they all swear by seeing it. And there have been hundreds of sightings of this creature apparently. And so every year now they have this Mothman Festival where people come and they made a movie about it back in the 80s with Richard Gere, I think. And so it's become this sort of, and the town, which was dying, kind of rallied behind this and said, okay, this, and they would get, you know, 25,000 people would come to tiny Point Pleasant, West Virginia, to this town every year for the Mothman Festival. It's just right. A weird and crazy thing. But there's all sorts of wonderful, weird things out there in America.
Wonderful, weird, and also sad weird, because you didn't shy away from talking about the poverty you saw in many parts of the United States, or towns that clearly had their best days long, long ago. One of those places was Clarksdale, Mississippi. And you went and explored some tragic history there and also some reasons for hope. Can you talk about that and Mississippi in general? I thought your take on it was moving and I thought quite insightful.
I loved Mississippi. I think the most exciting travel discovery I've made in the last 10 years easily is Mississippi. I think Mississippi's fantastic. I was just there this weekend. It's my fifth trip back since the book.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I was just down in Oxford and in Clarksdale as well. I did book events down there because I wanted to go back. And so I think, yeah, it was my fifth trip back. And I took my wife this time. I've been talking about it. She goes, I'm going with you down this time. And it was fantastic. You know, Mississippi in general, I had a northerner's kind of fear and snobbery of the deep south of Mississippi, like, whoa, Mississippi, why, you know, and I found it incredibly welcoming. I found the food terrific. I found the people all just direct and welcoming and the land fascinating down in the Delta particularly. But, you know, there's a certain lack of money with it creates a lack of adornment to a place. And it's just revealed in its sort of elemental phase. And it was beautiful. And I found it just fascinating. And Clarksdale particularly is, back in the day, meaning, you know, even the 70s to 80s, the 70s anyway, it was a thriving, bustling town, 25,000 people. And now it's largely a ghost town, as you said. And it's, well, it's about 15,000 now, but it's hugely the very rich landowners and poor people. And so it's a lot of it is shuttered. And but there's a blues scene there where, you know, many people say that it's the birthplace of the blues is Clarksdale. It's where, you know, Sam Cooke was born and Ike Turner was born there. And all these disproportionate amount of musicians came from right down there. And so there's all these little clubs that are still these juke joints that are still thriving down there. And a door that looks like it might be condemned, you push it open and it's like, whoa, there's a whole scene going on in there. And it's a great spot for music. You know, and I found the people there really interesting and fascinating. And
in the book, you say that you go to a juke joint and only three members of the audience show up. So it's this tiny crowd.
It was one of the great nights I've ever had of music. I have to tell you, I walked in this bar. I was the only one. I walked in. It was just me and the bartender and this guy warming up on his guitar. Then four other musicians came in and the bar looked like, oh, my, look at it. It had been bombed. I mean, it was a disaster. It was fantastic. Fantastic. And anyway, two other people came in. And so it was three in the audience and five in the band. And they rocked that house. And it was just great for like an hour and a half. And it was the most thrilling nights of music I've ever experienced. And it was a very, very memorable night. But I think that's what those happy accidents happen.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So that's the happy side of it. You also go into the fact and I encountered this when I was in my early 20s and was working as an actor. I was at the Alabama Shakespeare Festival, which is a thing, actually.
Yeah,
sure. It was a great theater. And in Montgomery, Alabama, they had just built a civil rights memorial. And I happened to have a college friend who was the district attorney for the city. And it kept getting bombed. The memorial could not keep it in one piece because people kept shooting at it, kept bombing it. And you in Clarksdale go to see where Emmett Till, who was the young boy who was accused of flirting with a white woman who was then lynched and was one of the catalysts for the civil rights movement. All of that happened at Clarksdale, right?
It happened down the road, about a half hour from Clarksdale in Money, Mississippi, this little tiny crossroads. And I went to the store where that happened, where he whistled at a white woman and she told her husband and they came and dragged him out of his... And he was visiting from Chicago. Emmett Till was a 14-year-old boy and he was visiting his cousins from and he was from Chicago and he was there like 2 days and he was probably just being a little, you know, regular city kind of cheeky kid. And he whistled out. Apparently he whistled at this white woman who was behind the counter and she told her husband they came and they lynched him. And it was a horrific thing. And because he was from Chicago and his mother said wanted an open casket in the world to see this, it became a flare that started, like you've mentioned, you know, was largely responsible for starting. And so I went to the site of the store, which is now ruined, completely in ruins, and just sort of a shell and overgrown. But it was, and there's just a little plaque up there about what happened here. And there's no money been spent to make a monument, to reclaim this place. It's just falling into decay, which I thought was an extraordinary metaphor for. But it was very powerful experience standing there sort of windswept. And I was there in like November and it was cold and the sun was a cold sun and the wind is going and across this, you know, from a cotton field. And it was just like, I think it's one of the real, I don't travel just to have a great time or for Instagram posts or bucket lists. You know, I think travel is about connecting ourselves to the wider world. And that was one of the most profound, amazing days of, you know, I have nothing to add. Like I mentioned in the book, there's nothing I can add. And I'm some white guy from New Jersey. What do I know of that experience? And yet every traveler discovers the known world for themselves, you know? And so to go bear witness to that for me was a big deal personally. And then I went to the place around not far from there where they dragged him out of the river, you know, where there was, as you mentioned, with your experience in Alabama, they'd put a plaque up there and somebody had thrown it in the river. They put another plaque up. Somebody shot it full of holes. They put another plaque up. Somebody shot it full. They put a fourth plaque up. Now that's bulletproof. And it's like to realize that there's still that much hate and ignorance in the world is, you know, upsetting, to say the least. But yeah. I think it's worth bearing witness and going to these places. Like that was just a bend in the river. I had to drive down some dirt road for 3 miles to get it. I wasn't sure where the hell I was. And I came upon it. And it's just a bend in a lazy river. And there's this plaque. And you just stand there in the silence. And the birds are singing. And you just think about what happened there. And it's powerful. And I think that's one of the most profound and valuable moments of my trip by far.
Yeah, yeah. No, it came across in the book. It was, I mean, what I like about it is you're not whitewashing American history. You're coming to these places sometimes by accident and finding real insights into what happened there. You also are a music fan. So you went to Tupelo. Where was Tupelo? Is that Mississippi too?
Yeah. Talk about a pilgrimage, Pauline. Tupelo. And I have to, I was just in Graceland this weekend. And,
oh, wow.
Yeah. And I'd been to Graceland years and years before. And I went because I flew out when I was down in Cork. So I had to drive up to Memphis to the airport. And so I had a couple hours early. So I went to Graceland, which is still amazing and spectacular and keeps getting better.
Oh, it's the weirdest place. I got to tell you, I had a miracle occur to me in Graceland. I went into the gift shop and lo, there was a mug with the name Pauline on it. That had never happened in my life before. Graceland. But yeah. So Tupelo is where Elvis was born?
Yeah, Elvis was born in Tupelo at the shotgun shack where he was born. You know, Graceland is full of all the, you know, success and excess, whereas Tupelo is just the bare bones poverty that Elvis came from. This two-room shotgun shack that was no indoor plumbing. And it's just this very humble little shrine. And it's an amazing experience because it is so simple. But I found it super moving. I had an amazing experience there. I love those little house sort of museums. You know, when I was just down in and on the trip as well, I was in Oxford, Mississippi, and I went to William Faulkner's home, which is Roanoke, you know, this where he wrote so many of his great novels. And so just to sort of go from there, and then not far away is Elvis Presley's Shotgun Shack. You know, it's just like this, it's crazy out there.
Well, and also the great thing about these little house museums is something that you raised in the book. I think you said, and I may be misquoting, that you get the same shot of endorphins by having an interaction with somebody you don't know so well than you do with deep friendships. And so that it's important to also have these fleeting friendships. And I find they're easier at these little house museums when you talk to people who are passionate enough to devote many hours a week to being the docent and telling the stories of another life lived in a home. These are people who want to connect. I always have great experiences at these smaller museums.
Yeah, I agree completely. They're always such care. And it's always the passion of one person who's taking care of this thing.
Yeah.
And they're almost as interesting as the thing, because every life is interesting once you scratch under a little bit. And it's like, why are you doing this? And then they talk about, oh, well, when I was a kid, my father, did, you know, and whatever their story is. And then you connect with them. And it's just such a amazing kind of experience. I love this little. I just think they're.
Well, you had a similar type of experience when you went to the boyhood home of Roy Orbison.
Well, and Roy's thing is in Wink, Texas. Yeah, and it wasn't his home, but it was this little storefront. And again, it was this one lady, Barbara, and she's dedicated her life. It was the town Roy Gray spent his teenage years in, and she spent her life dedicating and making this little tiny storefront museum about Roy Orbison. And she was as fascinating as the story of Roy was, you know. But that was a big thrill to go there. And it's in the middle of nowhere. I mean, Wink, Texas is in north near the panhandles, West Texas panhandle up there. And you got to really want to go to Wink to get there.
Right. And you shocked her by making a request. What was that request?
Yeah. Well, there's all sorts of, there's records and there's posters and whatever. And then they pull out the biggest shrine of in the museum is a pair of Roy's sort of those black iconic glasses that, and she pulled out a pair from underneath the counter. She pulled them out and unwrapped them like the precious relic they are. And I asked, can I try them on? And she just looked at me, oh, you know, she was shocked by this request. And she looks around and I'm like, well, there's nobody here. I mean, there's nobody in this whole town. And anyway, just for a second. So I got to try and wear Roy's glasses for a minute, which was thrilling.
Yeah. No, it's great. You also went to some of the beauty sites in the United States. You went to the Grand Canyon. You went to Arches and Canyonlands National Park. And then you went to one that I hadn't heard of before that you said was an extraordinary discovery, White Sands National Park. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yes. I had never heard of it either, and I totally stumbled upon it. I was coming up out of Texas there, and White Sands is where it's a national park inside of a missile range, the White Sands Missile Range, where the first nuclear bomb was tested. And so it's a national park that exists entirely within a military site. And it's just it's like being in the Sahara. And it was absolutely amazing. And I was there on a windswept day, and I was the only one out there. And it was, again, one of those thrilling discoveries, made all the more thrilling by the fact that I had no idea it existed. And then just, I'm like, whoa. And you realize in those moments, like, America is an amazing, just physically, America is an amazing, very.
So it was amazing because of the windswept Sahara-like visage, or was it, did you see missiles? I mean,
You don't see any of that. You don't see any of the military, anything. It's just, it's like you're in the Sahara Desert suddenly. You turn off the highway, go down this little road, and suddenly you're just in the middle of the Sahara Desert. It's the only way to describe it. And it was just the sheer raw nature of it I found fascinating.
Right.
You know, I love very remote places, and it felt very, very remote.
It sounds amazing. I'd love to go. And you end your journey visiting a man who I think makes sense for the end of a journey like this. There is a very famous, very accomplished, very celebrated travel writer named Don George.
He's not that famous, Pauline.
Well, he's famous in the world of travel writing. And I don't know, this is going to sound really gushy, but I consider him the living Buddha.
Don's pretty great.
He's just a guy who, just the joy and the wisdom pour off of him. He's just a remarkable fellow, I think.
I think so, too. And we had a great walk in the John Muir National, you know, amongst the Redwoods. It was a fantastic, and just listening to Don, just sort of asking him simple questions and letting him just muse as we walked through the Redwoods was just an extraordinary experience.
Right. Well, yeah, and you ask him at one point, you know, did you ever feel, what's the word? You know, I'm the more famous one, Andrew McCarthy says, because I was a movie star. And yet when we work together, I seem to be getting the, what's the word? People are thinking I'm doing it, but on the book you worked on together, you say he did most of the work. Why didn't that upset you, Don? You ask. And I thought it underscores my thesis that Don is the Buddha. How he responded, I thought. He said, I know myself. I'm okay with who I am. I'm not in competition with you, if that's a good way to sum it up. Or what would you say?
Sure, yeah, that makes sense. That's about right. I think probably better put than I did in the book. Yeah, I think Don is just at home in himself, you know, and that, and he's just a very generous spirit. And he laughs. He loves to laugh, which I think is probably the greatest gift he has for us.
No, I feel 10 times smarter than I actually am and 10 times funnier whenever I'm in Don's presence. He just brings out the best in people. And I should say at this point, you two listeners could be in Don's presence because he runs what is the best travel writers workshop every summer in Corte Madera, California. It's called the Book Passage Travel Writers Conference. Andrew, you're going to be there this summer, right?
I will be there this summer. Yeah, it is. It's an extraordinary several days of sort of fellowship and that, but also for people who really want to learn about the sort of the travel game, the travel writing business. It's huge, packed full of information, and it's a wonderful couple of days. I go back as often as I can.
Me too. And not only information, because that your writing will get better in the course of this. They have really intense and very helpful seminars that people go through, but you're going to make connections. There are people from all of the major travel publications that are left at this conference, like Afar and like the LA Times and, you know, not to make this too much of a commercial, but if you're interested, go to bookpassage.com. And right now, I know they have a scholarship for people who are, you know, it's not a free thing to do. So they do have a scholarship. You have to write an essay, I believe, and submit it. And that contest is going on now. So anyway.
Yeah, I recommend it too. I love going out there. I've always found it. I always learn a lot when I go there too.
Yeah.
And it's just great to reconnect with other travelers in that way and get ideas and things.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And your whole book is about reconnecting. And it really was a very moving, surprising book on the importance of friendship. I'll end with, you quote Aristotle talking about how there are three kinds of friends. And this made so much sense to me. There are the friends who you enjoy, you know them through work. It's not that deep a connection. And then there are the friends who bring you active joy, who you might find funny. And so you really enjoy being in their company. And then there's the real kinds of friends who they know who you are, or they know the good in you, and you know the good in them. And somehow the connection fuels that goodness in both of you.
Yeah.
I have to ask, after writing this, after doing this journey, are your connections still as strong, and are you a better person because of this?
Well, I do certainly feel more connected, and I have maintained those friendships that I'd let slide. And, you know, spoiler alert, at the end of the book, my son, he's the one that started saying, you don't have any friends. And at the end, I was on the phone talking to one of my friends several months after the trip was over. And I was laughing and laughing, and I hung up, and my son said, Dad, it's so nice to hear you talking to your friends and laughing like that. It's fantastic. And I did. I said, Sammy, well, you're the one that started it all with that comment. And he was like, what comment? So he didn't even remember. But yeah, I do. You know, I think I feel more connected. And the trip across America made me feel more connected to America in a really wonderful, profound way, too. I thought I knew America, and I didn't realize, you know, that we're so polarized in our country now in many ways politically. But and I didn't have any political conversations with anyone across the country. But America is still such a wonderful, welcoming, open-hearted, generous, receiving place. And I just was received everywhere that I went in America. I was thrilled by that and buoyed by that in a wonderful, surprising way.
That's really great to hear, because sometimes we hear from listeners and readers, I want to go to one area, but I'm of a different stripe politically, and I'm worried about going there. So, you know, even though you're clearly an Easterner, you never felt out of place.
Never, never. And the exact opposite. And, you know, I was open and interested, too. You know, I was interested in them. And everybody wants to tell their story. You know, everyone wants to be heard and received, you know. So I was just, I was willing, you know, and I was interested, and that was reciprocated all
over. No, definitely. No, that's the key to it. Well, thank you so much, Andrew. It's always such a delight reading your work and catching up with you.
You too. Well, thanks, Pauline. Thanks for having me.
And that's it for this week's show. I thank you so much for listening and watching. And to those who are traveling, may I wish you a hearty bon voyage.
coming home. I like you with your sour candy in the boathouse on the lake. But I hate, I hate, I hate, I hate, I hate. I hate the way it tastes. Oh, it's been so long. And I cannot help but wonder, are you ever coming home? When I see you with your sour candy, don't want it any other way. Oh, I just hate, I hate, I hate, I hate, I hate. I hate the way it tastes.
Hey guys, Aaron Miller here from Armchair Explorer, and I just wanted to let you know that our new series is out now. We've got kite skiing across Antarctica, Aboriginal storytellers, and the craziest whitewater race in the world. We're going on a bucket list hike across Italy. We're going to the fjords of Norway in search of the Northern Lights, and lots, lots more. Our goal is to take you on the trip of a lifetime every single week. You can find Armchair Explorer on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you're listening right now, and at voyescape.com.
If you want to travel more, ideally in luxury, but without the luxury price tag, this show is for you. I'm DeAndre Koch, and on Revolutionizing Your Journey, I use my unique vantage point as a financial advisor to break down exactly how my wife and I leverage credit card points and miles to fly business class, stay at five-star resorts, and take bucket list trips for a fraction of the cost. Each week, I share real strategies packed with actionable tips and interview some of the smartest travelers in the game to help you revolutionize the way you travel. Travel well, live boldly, and find Revolutionizing Your Journey wherever you get your podcasts.